Good afternoon. So last time I went over sort of the strategy I was hoping people would have used for RE2 Part B. And then we talked a bit about things that malware will do in response to software trying to either analyze it or detect it. So we first started by talking about some anti-analysis, it's called obfuscation techniques, obfuscation being a word for sort of making something more obscure. And we talked about techniques that were kind of focused on, you know, starting with high-level code and making it so that you kind of deliberately hide some of those high-level structures when it gets translated back into machine code. So like normally our compiler like preserves function calls and kind of the general control flow structure, we can make that, you know, not so apparent by, say, merging functions together. We can, you know, normally our compiler like preserves strings, we can kind of hide that kind of deliberately by just encoding the strings in some way or having them be generated, even if by relatively straightforward code. Similarly, we can hide flow control by transforming it to this kind of universal form where we change the flow control to changing some data, then using that data. And these aren't like robust techniques, but they're the kind of things we would expect malware that's concerned about us loading it into Cohedra might do. And then we talked about anti-signature techniques. So, you know, these sort of obfuscation techniques, they hinder analysis, but they probably make signatures easier. And kind of our sort of key anti-signature technique, and kind of the one that most of the others are kind of based on, is this idea of quote-unquote encrypting code, where we take our code and we have it be sort of scrambled in some way. It's like not really encryption because we have to decrypt it at runtime. You know, sort of like the key is there. It looks like, you know, I'm going to probably use the word encryption casually, but like, you know, you wouldn't say it's encrypted email if I send you, here's a zip file and the password is some X. You know, that's technically maybe that's encrypted, but it's not really, you know, if that's how I'm sending you things. But this is encrypted code in that sense. And we'll talk about kind of more sophisticated variants of that, and also talk about some things that arise out of those variants there, maybe don't necessarily involve this code encoding strategy. So questions about things we covered last time before we move on to talk a bit more about encrypted code. And, well, first with a little note on obfuscation stuff. So one note is I showed you in Cohedra what the encode literals that Tigris did to like hide literals did, and it looked a little hard to read. It turns out that Cohedra like does figure it out. You know, if you don't do additional work to hide it, if you just tell, oh, that param one is a character. And I'd like to briefly mention some other obfuscation ideas that are examples of things that Tigris does. One of which I mentioned was that adding useless function calls and if statements and things like that, that's another technique for obscuring flow control analysis. Some other strategies are kind of focused at like two other aspects of what we're doing when we're analyzing software. So one thing is that often we're temporarily modifying the code. Like a nice idea is to patch away things we don't like, you know, change the behavior. So something that some of these code will do is we'll take a hash of its own machine code and check that periodically. The idea being that if you don't remove that check, it will behave wrong, and therefore your patching will break things far away. Another is just deliberately modifying machine code at runtime, and this is because, you know, Cohedra, you know, is looking at what's in the binary when we're typically using it. Yeah, it has a debugger mode, but that's usually, you know, not where we want to start. So you can just sort of modify the machine code just for the sake of making it so you can't use what's in the original binary. You have to figure out, this instruction gets overwritten here, even if it's a relatively trivial thing being done. And the other strategy is kind of making the program into an interpreted program. So if you think of an interpreter, something like the Python interpreter or the Java virtual machine when it's not producing machine code, like we have some compiled form of our program, and rather than having it be compiled to machine code, we have it be compiled to something else, and we have an interpreter for the instructions in that. So a strategy Tigris supports, and what I understand is probably something people who like doing obfuscation think of doing, is they have like a kind of little custom virtual machine, like akin to the Java virtual machine that they build, and this turns the code into data for use later, and this, makes it so, it adds a bunch of extra steps to our analysis. Of course, there's nothing stopping us from doing all the sorts of analysis we do on normal machine code on the whatever the interpreted form is there. It just, adds a lot of extra effort and is fairly easy to automate as an obfuscator, though probably also like reasonable to automate as a, an analyst. And we'll talk about some things that are maybe better techniques to analyze things obfuscated in this kind of way. So you mentioned, so let's go back to our decryptors. So we have this idea of encrypted code. This is an idea of generating code at runtime in a sense. And we have this problem here that we're going to talk about what the solution to is that the decryptor code is still very distinctive. And like generally, we wouldn't expect it to appear in legitimate software. So something that we can see happening is that, let's vary the decryptor code. So the simple version of this is what the Jour book calls oligomorphic, where we have our code decryptor and we have a generator for that. And because the generator is encrypted, we kind of automatically have that kind of resistance to signature if our encryption mechanism varies things correctly. And we can have that generator randomize the coded outputs. And typically, in these simple versions of this, we just, have ways of generating different versions of each instruction, like add 4 versus subtract negative 4. We can just choose the registers we use kind of at random. We can say, this version's going to use CX, this version's going to use SI, and, just make that decision throughout. We can, instead of just inserting no ops, we can insert instructions that could do something but we know are useless in context. So for example, we can have, say, I know we're not gonna use R15, let's just generate random instructions that use R15. They're not gonna mess anything up in our decryptor code because it doesn't use R15, but they're gonna make the signature a lot more complicated to have to reason about that. So to give an example, here are 2 variants of the decryptor for Windows 95 virus, apparently called Memorial. And you can see that they like do little changes. They change the instruction order. They have some different choices for the loop instructions. And Shore says that they basically, they just made a few Boolean choices, but that meant that they had 96 different versions of this decryptor. So you can absolutely write a pattern for that, but it's a lot more tedious, a lot harder to match, because we have 96 times the things to look for. Like, it's not going to be 96 times the effort, because we know that our state machines kind of consolidate some of that work, but it's going to be a lot more work. And we can extend this idea to what Zora calls polymorphic, and that's also a common term you might see in the literature, where instead of just having these sort of small Boolean choices for little things we change, we kind of have a lot of random choices we make when we generate our decryptor. So as an example, this is two variants of the 1260 virus. And you can see here, one thing they do, this does, is I mentioned the idea we can add instructions that we know don't do anything in context. So this virus doesn't use in its decryptor SIBX and DX, so it just adds random instructions that use SIDX and BX to just make it harder to find a pattern to match things. You know, you change the key, and we have other like changes to the order of things. So this, you know, most of the code here is not functional, but most of it's just there to make the pattern matching a lot harder. And so we kind of have this, you know, generator in these types of viruses where in our encryptor code we have this decryptor generator that just chooses these random number of dummy operations and a random variant of the real instruction we want. And we can also add like changing the order, potentially other things. And sort of what seems to have happened in the antivirus world with this style of thing is usually people come up with a matcher for it, but it often takes sort of a lot of manual effort to come up with a reliable matcher for each of these decryptor generators. And if you actually want to do more work to detect the virus, maybe you actually want to decrypt the code and look at that to figure out how to do any repair or anything like that, or if you want to do further analysis. So we have this encrypted code pattern, and there's kind of a general idea that still exists of, you know, these programs often are called packers, that where we have code that we decode and run at runtime that's packed, we unpack it and run it. And these sort of exist a lot, and they exist for non-malware reasons. So there's a lot of actually popular packers for real software. And there's kind of two big motivations for doing that. So one is if you want to have your executable be as small as possible, this is how you do it. That you can have the decryption process, instead of doing decryption, you can do decompression. And this is how you make the smallest possible executable for something. And the other big reason is that these packers can be good at supporting, what if I want to pack my program and all its libraries in one executable file? These packers are going to support that kind of operation. Where that might be harder if you're, you know, distributing a traditionally compiled application. And an example of like a kind of legitimate packer is UPX, probably the most popular for people who want to do this for legitimate reasons. And you see, like, they're advertising, you know, oh, that, you know, it will take, like, half or less than half the space and will run exactly as before, and they're self-contained, they don't need any libraries. And they don't play in this game of encrypting the executable, even though we know that that's kind of what malware has done for a very long time with this strategy. And in their readme, they say, we will not add any sort of protection and or encryption. This only gives people a false sense of security because all, quote, protectors, end quote, can be broken by definition. And what they're getting at is, well, if you want to decrypt the encrypted code, well, it's not really encrypted very well, and you just run it. And that's kind of the easiest way to do it. We just run it. And you can mostly automate this process. And maybe some antivirus software does this. So you just run the code to decrypt it, and then you look at the decrypted code. So we can just run, so we can just take our piece of potentially malicious software, run it in an emulator for a while, and we could have some guesses as to when it might have decrypted things. So one example is if it jumps to data it wrote, probably this is what's happening. And then we can dump the memory, look at the decrypted code, we can do our signature scan, whatever we want to do. Or we have this alternate strategy where maybe we don't even care about extracting the decrypted code, we just look at what instructions actually got run and say, that's the thing we're going to check for a signature. We're not going to check the, we're not going to actually check the memory, we're just going to say, let's run this for a million cycles, see what instructions get run, compare that to a signature database of known malware instructions. And notably, this is like elegant in that, no matter how much effort a malware author puts into making the encryption algorithm more complicated, probably not really going to help them. And we also don't need to worry about what about extracting a variable key. We don't need any of that. We'll just have the code do it for us. Or run it and just have it do it for us. And kind of talk about, how hard is it to do this emulation? So I'll give an example of what seems to be one of the most used tools for malware analysis. If you were writing an antivirus engine, this might be too slow for what you want to do. I guess what I'm showing you will probably be too slow because I'm showing you stuff in Python. But the C API might be fast enough. So this is a CPU emulator, and most of this dynamic analysis stuff you'll find is at some point based on QEMU, which is a CPU emulator, and I gather Unicorn is historically based on QEMU. So it's an emulator where conceptually what it's doing is it takes an instruction, deep parses it, decodes the machine code, and simulates the effect. In practice, it supports just-in-time compilation, so it can convert blocks of instructions to machine code and run them, which means that it can be fast. Though I'm going to show things where it definitely would not be fast that we might want to do for analysis. And to give an example, of how you might use this, so here, just running a little bit of assembly. So I have my assembly code here. I move 100 into EDI and multiply RDI times 2. And I convert this to an object file and extract the text segment where the code is from the object file into this binary file that only has that machine code. And then I load that code. I load the Unicorn emulator. I say, I'd like to have memory at address 10000, and please put the code there, and please run until you get out of the region where I put the code. And then I say, okay, what was RDI? And I just find out. And you can see we can generalize this to run whatever we want, and because this is an emulator, we can do more than just running things. We can examine things in great detail to find out whatever we want to find out about the code we're running. So here, for example, I say, here's a function I'd like you to run before running every single instruction. It just does that. And I can use these kind of hooks in the emulator to do whatever kind of analysis I want to do. And this is how that tool I mentioned called Unipacker does that generic decryption strategy, generically decrypts handle runs packers until they decrypt, and then figures out what's there. So kind of the code for what they're doing is that they read the executable file, they read the load segments or whatever the equivalent is for the OS they're using. They're mostly targeting Windows, so it's a little different. They map all that stuff, they map all the libraries the executable needs into the emulated memory. They add a hook and they just say, are we in code that has been modified? If so, dump the memory now, we've unpacked it. So like getting all the details of this working, you know, is not trivial, but like conceptually it's not actually that hard. Because someone else wrote the emulator. Like, I would never want to write an x86-64 emulator, but fortunately, you don't have to. It's already there. And I guess to mention kind of other tools that, you know, in this space that I have not tested, but the kind of obvious thing to do with the emulator is that, well, the emulator here, like, it's just running machine code, so it doesn't handle the case where we're interacting with the system much. So people have done the work where they take that emulator and they add emulation of a lot of system operations. So like they, you know, say, emulate the file open, read, write operations and record them and make them go to fake files or files of your choice. And you can kind of extend this idea to analyze, to do this as more of an analysis technique. So we could do signature matching, or we could do this as something we do in addition to like running Dihedra on something to figure out what it does. And as an example of like what they're targeting, this Kuling project, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and Chinese isn't good, is targeting, also has like loaders that target bootloaders. So one of their ideas is that if you have a bootloader virus, you can figure out what it does by emulating it and having emulation of its interaction with the hardware. And another example that's also in this space, would be Panda.re. This is kind of looks like research software, but it illustrates another thing we can do with this type of emulation, which is that they do emulation of a whole OS. So they just run a stock version of Linux or Windows and emulate the whole system, and they do a whole system record. So you can record everything and replay it later with some analysis to hook and look at the instructions that are running in that replay. With the idea being that you record it once, and then you replay it several times and write new things to check what instructions are being run each time. And so that's another way of kind of, we can think of using these emulators as kind of an analysis tool. And it kind of completely sidesteps the issue of, well, if the code's encrypted, we can look at what instructions actually run and analyze that in this way. Obviously, it's a lot more computationally expensive, but you know, this is an option both from a I want to analyze malware point of view and an option from an I want to detect malware point of view, is we can do both of these things. And this is also a reason why we'll talk later about techniques for malware to avoid being emulated or virtualized. It's why it's a big concern to many malware authors, is because this enables such powerful, relatively simple analysis, even though, yeah, the emulator isn't simple, but using it is relatively simple. And as I mentioned, we can get traces from here, so we could do our analysis by just taking a trace. We probably want to have it compressed in some way, but we could imagine detecting signatures on this. And this deals with things like self-modifying code. So because this emulation is a big concern, I mentioned that malware will try to behave differently. And we'll talk about a few of the techniques that are common to do that. And most of them are pretty conceptually simple, but still hard for our authors of our emulator or virtual machine to fix. So one thing is we can query the devices. We can say, let's see if this machine has any device, has the devices we'd expect a real machine to have. And if you just take a typical random virtual machine, this is a giveaway. That a normally configured virtual machine, you know, is going to have like the VirtualBox Ethernet card or the VMware disk driver. You know, that's kind of going to be a big giveaway. You can just detect you're in a virtual machine and do something different. Now, you can fix this as someone setting up the virtual environment or emulator by making sure all the devices that appear to be there match some realistic enough machine. But that's work and, you know, hard to do depending what devices they're looking for. So another thing that malware can do is they can time how long things take. Because the emulator is going to be slower, you know, things that require extra handling in our emulation, like if we're simulating the file operations, those are going to be a different speed than they usually are. If we're allocating memory, that probably works differently. You know, so that's an annoyance, you know, and that's something that's harder to deal with. Like, inherently, our emulation or virtualization is slow. Kind of the principled solution for preventing that from being a problem is to have virtual clocks in your emulated environment. Another thing is that, you know, writing an emulator is hard, and we talked about, for example, I have this cool Qlang which has emulating all these system operations. It's not the operating system author, it's going to miss some. So we can try to attack the emulated operating system features or the emulated CPU features and look for things that an emulator is likely, or virtualization environment is likely to not handle. You know, we don't care about those operations, but we can use that to detect that we're not being run normally. And this is something we might see malware concerned about that doing. You know, and some of these might be, you know, relative things that are like really annoying to actually deal with in an emulation, right? Like multi-threading is pretty annoying to set up as an emulator or virtual machine author, especially if we're doing instruction tracing. But definitely would be in a real OS, for example. And there's some more like simpler strategies. So one is that if we're thinking of what the anti-malware software is going to do, it's probably going to, we're going to like run for a little bit to try to get the decoded version of the virus, for example. So we can just take a while, because if we're thinking of how, of what the detection scenario is versus what our attack is, for our attack, we probably don't care if the malware doesn't start until 3 hours after it's triggered versus immediately. But boy, does the antivirus software not want to run the emulation for 3 emulated hours, which is probably, you know, maybe days not emulated. So we can just take too long to actually do our operations and hope to, you know, get out of the patience level of who's analyzing us, or, you know, especially for automated checks. You know, they're going to have to stop running things eventually, and probably sooner than when we actually run for real. And another thing we can do is we can just not consistently do our malicious activity. So we can have our malware code be, check or make a random number if it's, say for do the malicious thing. And most of the time, when the analyst or the antivirus emulator runs things, everything's normal. But if we are in some place where we get a lot of chances to try this, eventually our malicious code will run, and that's probably good enough for our goal. And another thing that's parallel to our, idea of attacking the patients is that we can just use more resources than our analyst or especially antivirus software is willing to use. So a lot of, if antivirus software is doing this strategy, you probably don't really want to emulate something that uses a gig of RAM. So you can just have your malware use a gig of RAM and then do something malicious. And you can see it's hard to come up with a nice way of dealing with this beyond that doesn't reject legitimate programs, right? Because some legitimate programs that you are going to use a gig of RAM, you shouldn't just assume it's safe because it's using a gig of RAM, and or assume it's unsafe, right? Doesn't really tell you that, but probably you don't want to try to emulate that. So something that came up with this, I guess I should ask for questions. So questions about our various anti-virtualization techniques and the corresponding why we like running things in emulators or virtual machines for looking at malware. Okay, we were looking at packers, which like generated code and ran it. And something you might notice from looking at our recent executable formats is that all the packers I showed you seem like they won't work in kind of modern executable formats. That we're used to, when we look at an executable, that memory is writable or executable, but not both. And so something we can look for that's maybe more fundamental is that it's kind of suspicious if we see memory being writable and then being executed at all, and it's rare for modern programs to, have memory be both writable and executable, which is exactly what our packer code was relying on. We were XORing, not packer, our decryption code. We were XORing stuff that we were going to jump to. And most of the time, we have this property that memory is writable or executable. This historically was not the case. And it was not the case until surprisingly late. Until the early 2000s, there wasn't actually good hardware support for making memory readable but not executable. And after that, a bunch of OSs kind of turned on the feature of actually using that hardware support. But historically in the 90s, it wasn't really a thing. So that's one reason why a lot of the malware we talked about was structured that way. And if we look at current programs, usually they don't have memory that's set writable and executable. It's still a thing you can do. And we'll have some examples of things in assignments which deliberately, let that happen. But usually, that's not kind of enabled by default, and if we want to switch between writable and executable, usually we have to make a request to the OS to change how the memory is set up. On Linux, this is done with the mprotect syscall, for example. Now, I say usually programs don't write code and run it, but there are exceptions, and this means that we can't, have our antivirus software just have a rule that if it's changing code from writable to executable, something's wrong. So one example, as I told you, those emulators are fast because they can translate blocks of machine code into stuff to actually run on the real hardware. That's called binary translation. Yeah, and that is going to use this feature deliberately. Most kind of Java and JavaScript implementations write machine code at runtime and execute it. So if you want to just say, don't allow this, you're going to break all of those, which is probably going to really disappoint people. Their web browser doesn't work. And if we think of what like dynamic linkers are doing, it could look like loading code from a file and writing code, you know, by loading it from a file and running it. Probably we can distinguish that, but that's tricky. And we mentioned that packers have these legitimate uses, that there are actually legitimate uses of the pattern of load a program from somewhere and jump to it, you know, mostly for that compression or nicer packaging reason. Okay, so we talked about kind of detecting the decrypted code. Let's talk about which of these techniques would cause problems and which are easier, harder to work around. So would make, you know, defeat that idea, that simple heuristic I said of like, let's run it until it jumps to code it wrote. So which of these would defeat that and which of these would be easiest to work around?
Yeah, I feel like that was one of the easiest parts.
Okay, so let's start with, does anyone think any of these would not be a problem? Which is, we just handle them automatically. Yeah. So this one you think sometimes we handle for free. I think it varies. It depends, like, when does the program exit is the question, as you pointed out. If the program kind of exits on its own, yeah, we handle it for free. If the program needs user intervention to exit, a lot harder. But yeah, so it depends on the type of program we have. But sometimes the program A is free, sometimes it's a lot harder. Any others people think are kind of free? No. Okay. I think C is free. The address doesn't matter. We can just scan all the memory. Doesn't matter where it is. Okay. So, and I think all the others definitely something we have to do some extra work. So what? Does someone have a case for one of them being the hardest to work around? Yeah. E? Why do you think E is the hardest?
So that could basically, like, if it decrypts another code decryptor, that could be pretty much anything, and it would be, like, really hard to identify.
Okay, you say it would be hard to identify if that happened? Okay. Mm-hmm. Other... Okay, so you think B would be hard because our workaround would have to be, we'd have to simulate that input somehow. We have to simulate the right inputs, and that, you know, at the least, that seems like something that's hard to do in a way that's very generic based for what program we're running. Other... ideas? Everyone just seeing B and E? Okay. So I think the workaround for D is you just change the time in the emulated system. That's maybe easiest. I think E is pretty easy to work around in that you just give it a chance to keep running to hit the second decryptor. Basically, you apply your strategy recursively. It's not great, it's not efficient, but it's an idea that's like doesn't require any new functionality, whereas B requires new functionality in our emulation. But I can see the case either way for either of those. Questions, comments on, or other things to bring up? Okay, so talk to packers, but so we have this decryption strategy. So I mentioned this was called polymorphic, and that still kind of has signatures from, even if we have multiple variations of the decryptor, there's signatures. Also, we have this issue that if the decryptor works, you know, in a certain way, we could imagine an antivirus engine writing its own version of that decryptor and just figuring out, oh, this might be encrypted code, let's check. Let's try decrypting it and check a signature on it. So there was some malware that in response to kind of these reactions to dealing with decryptors well, kind of said, let's not have any like unchanging code anywhere. Like not even encrypted stuff that doesn't change. So you can just like, you know, guess some decryptions and match a signature on them. Or like think this might be the key, match the signature, that sort of thing. Or run the code for a little bit and check the signatures. And so there was code that aimed to apply the same strategy we talked about for changing, having kind of a random decryptor, but apply that kind of idea to the whole body of the malicious code. And there was self-replicating malware which did this, where every replication would change all the code in that same kind of way, where we had kind of alternatives. So you can see here where, you know, in this case, you know, we just randomly choose what registers we use, which, yeah, there's still a signature there, but boy, is that complicated. And we could imagine combining this with also randomly choosing different ways to write the move instructions. You know, you can write a move as like a XOR and an add, for example. And other things we can change. And so there were a bunch of viruses which were so-called metamorphic, where they had implemented what's called a mutation engine, where instead of having this piece of code which like says write a move, write a something, they take their machine code and they disassemble it, transform it back into new instructions and write that out. So they don't need to have, they don't have a code generator, they have a machine code to machine code transformer. And this means that the whole thing gets transformed, including the code that does the transformation. So this seems really complicated, especially since these were in practice on x86. So you might wonder, what were they doing? You know, how do they make this practical? And there's some things which make it like less hard than it, you know, seems like it would be. So one thing is that, you know, the virus author knows what instructions they use. They don't need a full disassembler. They just need to disassemble the opcodes it actually uses. And there were only about 61 of those, and they only used these type of operands. They didn't use the full generic type of operands. And then, you know, so that was, well, and then they just did transformations and they just had some templates for how to transform the code into some instructions into equivalent instructions. In this case, they weren't concerned about the code getting bigger. You might imagine if that was a concern, you might want to do this differently. Now, a challenge with this is that they need to deal with what if there's jumps or other references in the code. So that gets us to the last step, which we'll talk about next time. We have to do relocation. So we have to do something akin to what the linker does, but on a machine code. And this seems really complicated, but there's a relatively elegant way where basically we just keep track of a table mapping our original addresses to our new addresses. And so using this, they have this generic machine code to machine code transformer that kind of makes it so the whole piece of thing is very signature resistant. So we'll finish up talking about how that relocation stuff works next time, and then move on to some other topics.